Hello, everyone. Welcome. This is Just Human number 265. I am in a hotel room in Texas here for the Gart event in Dallas. Well, South Lake. Very excited about it. Happy to be here and looking forward to meeting a bunch of you. I pre-recorded an episode for today, 265. I've already done this once and got interrupted about 20 minutes in. Had to stop recording, then came back to it, rushed to try to get through some stuff and made a lot of mistakes. And I just didn't feel good about it. I just didn't like that episode. And I messed with trying to splice it together. And it would have been like an hour and 10 minutes. So a shorter one, but I just wasn't happy with it. I didn't like it. So instead of putting out an episode I don't like, and instead of not putting out any episode at all, I decided that I would rush to my room and sit down and record this episode with much of the same material that I went over in the previous recording, plus some stuff that's broken today. And I'm just going to go with it. Just going to go with what I have, and I'll stop when it's time for me to go to the dinner event. So welcome. Hope you guys are doing well. This is going to be coming out on Friday, so happy Friday to all of you. If you enjoy what I do, give me a follow. Check out my socials. If you would like to support what I do, hit the thumbs up on Rumble, number one. That's the most important, probably. And next, if you want to give direct support, there's Ko-Fi.com, there's Benson Honey Farms, Bootleg Products, Manly Cans, merch, Venmo, all of these ways right here. The support links are in the description of the show, and they're on my Linktree. And thank you to everyone who gives me support in these ways. The best way to support the show, if you just want to do it here and there, probably Ko-Fi.com, because you can just give me like a $5 cup of coffee and you can leave a little message, which I love. Or you can go to Substack.com, justhuman.substack.com, sign up either for free or for a paid subscription. And that's the best way to support the show. That is also how you get the podcast version of the show. The podcast version always comes, because I've been doing these pre-records, the podcast version always comes out typically the night before the show goes live the next day. So if you're mostly listening anyway to the show, the podcast version is for you. So, and it's free. It's completely free, whether you have to everybody. So justhuman.substack.com, you can point it towards your favorite podcast player, Apple's, Podbean, wherever. Or you can listen on the Substack app. Okay. First, let's talk about Smirnoff. So, Alexander Smirnoff, this is the FBI informant who has been an informant for the FBI for many years, a highly credible one, reportedly, who has helped on many, many, many cases, including foreign intelligence cases, is a double agent, it seems, or maybe a triple agent. He's worked and has many contacts with Israeli intelligence, and I think he's a dual Russian and Israeli citizen, many contacts with Russian intelligence, including like very recently, like just months ago, and many contacts, of course, with the FBI. Highly credible informant, reportedly, and yet he caused a submission to be made to the FBI, which had a bunch of false information in it. And in a follow-up interview, he lied to the FBI. And that information went into FD-1023 form, if I recall the acronym correctly. And that form became very famous thanks to Grassley, Comer, Jordan, and some others last summer when they were talking about this FD-1023, this CHS report that had allegations and information in it that Hunter and Joe Biden had received $5 million each from the owner of Burisma in exchange for them protecting the owner of Burisma and Burisma itself. And those allegations are very familiar to us. We've heard them made by several people. Smirnoff is the CHS who told the FBI about this back in like 2020. The problem is, Special Counsel Weiss says, he has information, and his investigation has led him to conclude that Smirnoff lied about his trips, lied about the conversations he had, lied about the people that he met, lied about this bribe. And so he has brought these charges against him as part of his special counsel investigation. Now, a lot of people think this is some kind of cover up that Weiss is protecting the Bidens somehow, which is at best convoluted, considering that he's literally prosecuting Hunter for several tax charges and then the gun charge, which really shouldn't even be a charge. I have to admit, I kind of agree with the motion to dismiss in the gun case. And then taxation is theft, though, so I would agree with a motion to dismiss the tax stuff, except for that it was the law at the time. But so this Smirnoff case is really interesting to me because a lot of people are upset about it because they think Weiss is going after the wrong person. And they're confused about these allegations allegedly being false. The thing is, they're false as relates to Smirnoff's telling of them and how he learned this information. The contention here is not that the Bidens are not corrupt or that the Bidens never received any kind of bribe at all or that the Bidens didn't do anything to protect Burisma. A lot of people think they did. And there's a lot of circumstantial and some indirect and even some direct evidence that the Bidens are corrupt, right? Especially as relates to Ukraine and Burisma. But the stuff that came from Smirnoff specifically is erroneous. Criminally so, according to Special Counsel Weiss. So I think the thing not to get lost here, where a lot of people get lost with this case and with considering Special Counsel Weiss's actions here, is that people get lost thinking that Smirnoff's lies mean that the rest of the stuff that we've been told or learned about the Bidens is also false. Like there's some sort of dissonance there, but that's not what it means. It means that Smirnoff's telling of how he acquired that information is a lie. Now, why would Smirnoff lie? Why would this highly credible FBI informant who had helped with so many investigations and been paid lots and lots and lots of money for helping, why would he lie about these meetings that he had and the conversations that he had? And it seems, in my opinion, and as we went over in the show I did about this indictment, which I think was two parts, right? Or three parts. There's a playlist on my Rumble. It seems like he got all his information from Derkach, who was also indicted, but not by Special Counsel Weiss. But by one of the people that were on Durham's team, Adam Small. And what was the other guy? His name will come to me in a minute. He's another prosecutor that worked with Durham. Anyway, his name will come to me in a minute. So, as you guys recall from that, Derkach did a press conference where he alleged all these same things. So it seems like Smirnoff took the allegations he saw Derkach make, or was given from Derkach, maybe, inserted himself into the story, and then went to the FBI and told them all this information. And it seems like he did this in order to try and set up the Bidens, or set up the FBI. Who knows? There's some motive here that is yet to be revealed, it seems to me. There's some reason why he went and lied. And I think that's actually the most interesting thing about this case is why. Why did this CHS decide to fabricate this information and give it to the FBI in 2020? Was he doing it to gain favor for himself in some respect? Did somebody pay him to do that? To do it? Is it part of some elaborate trap? Or did he just sense an opportunity? Like, ooh, I don't think Biden's going to win. I'll go and tell all this stuff to help sink his campaign and maybe I'll get rewarded for it or something. I don't know. But last time we covered this case, Smirnoff was trying to get out of jail. You may recall. He says he has a lot of eye problems and he needs to have medical care and he already has surgery set up and he made all these motions and he's really, 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 really been trying to get out of jail. And this guy is a huge flight risk. He has access to millions of dollars. He has access to multiple foreign intelligence apparatuses and agencies. He has he's a dual passport, so Russia and Israel. The guy has the means and the ways and the knowledge and everything in order to escape. So he's really trying to get out. The judge denied that. last time we were looking at this case, the judge had denied his motions to get out of prison and said he would have to get medical care within the prison system. And if I remember right, he had his first appointment last Friday. Or maybe it was the Friday before. Something like that. But since then, we've had a new filing come out. And I was going to read the whole thing, but I'm not going to, just to save a little bit of time today. But on the now deleted Recycle Bend, episode 265, I read the whole thing. But what you need to know about this case is that it has been delayed. Which the trial has been delayed, which was always going to happen. The trial was originally set to begin this week, and that was always, this coming Monday. That was always not, like, just far-fetched. Like, they haven't had any of the dates they need to have. This thing has been kicking around with medical stuff and bond stuff. So they agreed to continue the trial date all the way out to December 2nd of this year. And both DOJ, Special Counsel Weiss, and Smirnoff have agreed that they're sending this thing way out to December. And they set a calendar of other stuff on there, right? The most interesting thing about this stipulation, where they asked for this continuation and new trial date, is that the DOJ, well, Special Counsel Weiss's team, said they have over 4 million individual files of discovery. Over 4 million individual files that they and the defense have to work through to prepare for the trial, and that over 2 million of those individual files are in another language. So there's a lot of work to do to get ready for the trial, and it makes a lot of sense, and both parties agreed to put the trial off until December. Now, the black pill take that is going to be very common about this, or at least was when the news broke, is that they're delaying the trial until after the election in order to protect Biden. So, which I guess kind of makes sense, even though it's still kind of convoluted to me, because it's like, okay, the narrative is that Special Counsel Weiss is covering up for the Bidens by prosecuting a guy who lied about them about bribery. And then they're putting the trial off until after the election in order to what? Wouldn't you want it to happen before the election in order to influence it? Because you would have that guy getting convicted for lying about the Bidens before the election. Wouldn't you want to, if you were trying to manipulate things, wouldn't you want it to be happen before the election and not just kind of be out there where it was kind of unresolved? Maybe not. Also, if Weiss is covering up for the Bidens, then wouldn't he have not prosecuted Hunter in two different states? But I don't know. Maybe I'm wrong. So Smirnoff thing is getting put off all the way into December. This is a case I plan on covering. I'm not signed in right now, but if I was, you would see I have alerts turned on for it. I'm going to keep covering this case because I'm highly, highly interested in it. I think there's a good chance that Smirnoff leads to others. And I think that Smirnoff, United States v. Smirnoff, is a mirror to Danchenko and Christopher Steele. Both Christopher Steele and Danchenko, highly credible intelligence officers, highly credible informants to the FBI, both fed false information to the FBI. Both should have been charged, only one was. But it's like this mirror to Russiagate, Spygate, where you have this CHS, just like we have with Danchenko and Christopher Steele, who gave fabricated false information to the FBI, which sparked an investigation, which consumed a lot of media attention. I just don't think that's an accident. My sense of it is that Americans are possibly being taught a lesson here about CHSs and some sort of game going. Maybe we're being informed of that there's this whole system that has existed where informants are paid to give false information to law enforcement in order to effectuate some sort of action against an opponent in some realm or something. You know, like this is too much of a coincidence. There's something more here. All right. Next thing, Menendez. We at the Just Human Show should all feel pretty happy about the Menendez case right now because, as we've talked about before, Nadine and Robert Menendez are throwing each other under the bus. It's happened. We talked about it possibly happening. We talked about how they did not have the same sets of attorneys. We talked about some comments made here and there. We've gone over this indictment and the superseding indictments in this case on this show. And we talked about how Nadine seems to be the nexus. She seems to be the handler of Bob Menendez. And so it is not surprising to us that her case and his have been severed. Heck yeah. So hers, let me see. I was going to see when I saw the date for hers down here. Now, Bob's trying to get his case severed from everybody. And the judge so far hasn't done that. But that's some of these motions up here. He's trying to get his case severed from everybody else. Well, what the judge did do was sever Nadine's. Here it is, the order right here. It's hereby ordered that the government adjourns the May 6th trial date. No, the government's motion to adjourn the May 6th trial date is denied. There will be a pre-trial conference as to Nadine on June 3rd. Nadine shall obtain new counsel. To transfer to venue in District of New Jersey are denied. Her motions to do that are denied. The motions for a bill of particulars by Menendez and Hanna are denied. The motion to sever as to Nadine and Robert are dismissed as moot since the court has already severed Nadine and rescheduled her trial. Let me see, where is her trial rescheduled to? Hold on just a moment. Now, we've talked about this before, but about the severance thing, but the last time we looked at this case, it had not happened. The judge had not ordered it. So I'm looking for where it is that he did order it. It first got mentioned back in February. That was when we first talked about it on this show. Motion to sever. Okay. Order. That was at the top. She was already severed. So where? The court already severed. See, there's something here that annoys me. In this written order right here, it says that they already gave an order to do a thing, but then it doesn't list which docket entry did that. So that kind of annoys me. Support, media coalition, opposition. No, those aren't orders. Pending severance motion 6 and 251. Those are the motions. Okay, let me search order. And let me see what the judge's other orders are. It's going to be before the 16th. Maybe he did it at this conference right here, or maybe it's sealed. See, here's the one, April 11th. By April 11th, he'd already severed it. And then here's a conference that was supposed to happen on April 11th. And it just says on several motions that are pending and more sealed documents right here, which might be sealed motions to sever. It could, the judge's order to sever might be sealed. It might be one of these right here, or it could be this one right here from the 10th. Because by the 11th, it happened. So anyway, her trial has been severed from Menendez. And one of the things that I noticed in a more recent filing from Menendez, I don't think it's this one. That's not this. And I don't think it's this either. I'm going to find it. Don't worry. This is a very professional show. And I always have things set ready. I thought that said ghost. Like ghost of Patrick Henry. That's a ghost, not gauche. Where is this? It might be this one. Yeah, I think it's this one. All right, I'm not going to wait, read the whole thing, but this is a one of the most recent memos by Menendez. And okay, so this right here is a motion from Bob. And it's for motion to dismissed. It's a memo in support of Bob Menendez's motion to dismiss based on lack of venue and duplicity and to sever the trials. Okay. So he's trying to get his trial severed. He's also arguing for his case to be dismissed. Okay. Both those things are in this 49 page motion. Up here at the first part, we're talking about venue. Check out his comment right here. He wrote, or his attorneys wrote, the Second Circuit has applied a but-for causation standard. An act qualifies as an overt act for venue purposes if the conspiracy's criminal objectives would not have been realized without it. So one of his arguments he's making is that he needs a venue change. This SDNY doesn't have jurisdiction here because Bob didn't, none of the actions that Bob Menendez took effectuated the criminal conspiracy here. He was unaware of it, and he was just being a senator. And this other stuff going on wasn't him. It wasn't him involved with it. And then they're trying to get jurisdiction here by saying that actions that were taken in the conspiracy involved him, but he's saying that none of those actions that actually would make the conspiracy successful or carry on to the criminal objectives of that conspiracy, or to the objectives, that none of those things occurred when Bob was in the SDNY, because Bob didn't have anything, didn't know about them. He wasn't trying to do it. He said, look, the defendant's travel through the district of prosecution could qualify as an overt act because they had not done so with the face-to-face meetings, which were a regular part of the fraudulent scheme. They would not have occurred. So they argue that the prosecution is arguing that, look, the face-to-face meetings wouldn't have occurred if Bob Menendez didn't travel to this district. But he's saying, like, look, no. They would have done what they were going to do anyway. I just had a face-to-face meeting. Now, there's something else that he said in here that's really interesting that just shows where his mind's at. The indictment does not sufficiently allege a basis for this venue because three of those acts were allegedly performed by co-conspirators without the senator's involvement, and only two alleged acts remotely concern the senator. Okay. They're trying to separate Bob from the rest of the defendants. That's why they want to get Bob separated from the rest. That's one of their goals right here, or maybe the goal. There was another one that had he's also tried to hide behind the speech and debate clause. Okay. This is where he's talking about getting separated from the dean. Okay. Let's look at this part. Okay. Senator Menendez and the dean have spousal privileges that limit each other's ability to present a defense and receive a fundamentally fair trial. Okay. That's the argument. What they're positing. As summarized above, a joint trial of Senator Menendez and Nadine risks depriving Menendez, Senator, of the ability to offer, quote, essentially exculpatory evidence that would be available to him if tried alone. Precisely the type of situation the Supreme Court identified in Safiro as warranting separate trials. This could happen in at least two ways. First, we are informed that in an attempt to defang Senator Menendez's defense regarding lack of knowledge, which threatens to impugn Nadine's conduct and culpability, Nadine might assert the, quote, marital communications privilege to prevent Senator Menendez from testifying at a joint trial to marital communications with Nadine that served to exculpate Senator Menendez. For instance, the indictment alleges significant conduct occurring after Nadine and Senator Menendez were married, which conduct necessarily would include or implicate private communications between Senator Menendez and his wife. And it mentions alleging that Senator Menendez and Nadine attended dinners with the Egyptian officials, alleging that Hanna caused items of value to be delivered to Senator Menendez and Nadine's home, alleging that Senator Menendez, via his wife, conveyed information about planned questioning from other senators to an Egyptian official. At trial, as part of his defense, Senator Menendez may elect to testify to communications with his wife that serve to materially decrease any inference of culpability on Senator Menendez's part. Senator Menendez will explain, for example, what he and his wife discussed contemporaneously with their dinners with Egyptian officials, which colored his understanding of the purpose of such dinners. The explanations that Nadine provided for why Hanna and Uribe had provided her certain monetary items, the reasons why he sent his wife a series of questions that other senators purportedly intended to ask an Egyptian official, and many more topics. While these explanations and the marital communications on which they rely will tend to exonerate Senator Menendez by demonstrating the absence of any improper intent on Senator Menendez's part, they may inculpate Nadine by demonstrating the ways in which she withheld information from Senator Menendez or otherwise led him to believe that nothing unlawful was taking place. They have turned on her. Now, it's a fine argument. Doesn't necessarily mean they turned on her, but I think they have, because they're saying that in order for Bob to protect himself, he needs to sever himself from Nadine so that her putting privileges over communications doesn't make him look worse, because he needs to be able to put protections where he wants and privileges where he wants, and he needs access to communications that he can put forth that exonerate him. But it's necessarily true that as he exonerates himself with these communications, he implicates her, which is his defense. His defense is ignorance and blaming his wife. The second way in which a joint trial of the two married defendants in this case would prejudice Senator Menendez is more subtle, but no less important. On top of the risk that Nadine will assert a marital communications privilege to preclude exculpatory testimony from Senator Menendez, a joint trial would force the senator to choose between two important rights: his right to testify in his own defense and his competing but no less vital right to refuse to testify against his spouse. Were Senator Menendez to be tried alone, there would be no conflict between these two rights. Senator Menendez could freely offer testimony in his own defense with no impact on Nadine's case. And if called as a witness in Nadine's separate trial, Senator Menendez could decide whether to exercise the spousal testimonial privilege to refuse to testify in his wife's case without compromising his own rights. But by combining the couple's trials, an untenable conflict emerges. In a joint trial, if Senator Menendez chooses to exercise his right to testify in his own defense, he will necessarily have to waive his spousal testimonial privilege not to testify against Nadine. All right, so in this narrow way right here, I could see how this is beneficial to both of them. And so I'm not fully set that they've turned on each other, but I really do think they have. But I'm not fully 100% on it, because there is an angle here where them having separate trials allows them to protect each other just a little bit and preserve their own rights. But the thing is, what's already happened is the judge is separating Nadine's trial, who, again, I think is Bob's handler, and kept Senator Menendez with Hanna and Uribe, which is kind of odd. And I think that maybe what's going on in those sealed filings, this gets me back to something I speculated about way back when we started looking at this case. There's so many sealed filings in this docket. I'll show you. Ah, I don't know if y'all could hear that noise, but I did. If you type in sealed, you get 80 responses. Now, many of those are double, so let's just call it 40. Okay. There's like 40 sealed documents on this docket. So, well, between 30 and 40. So I just wonder if Nadine has already been working to cut a deal with the DOJ to get her to flip against Uribe, Hanna, and Bob. And that might be why she's been severed, but they haven't been severed from each other. And that makes a lot of sense to me. It also makes sense to me that she's the handler. And if you flip Uribe or Hanna, you may not get the rest of the crew because they're lower down. But if you flip her, you can get everybody. If you flip Bob against them, then it's just not going to happen because his ego. It's just not going to happen. So she's the one to go for. And I think it's worked. I really do. But that's just my speculation. All right. Let's go to the next one. You guys have been with me on this. Like, we've been talking about this since this case came down. Really excited about it. Because he's a swamp creature. I love watching swamp creatures go down. Okay, United States v. Biden in California. A lot of things I want to read on this, and we don't have time, but Hunter's team has been pushing to get this case thrown out, and they have been filing many exhibits, as you can see on screen right now, and they have filed many motions to dismiss based on selective vindictive prosecution, based on jurisdiction, based on all sorts of things. And they've been denied. The judge made this huge order, which I very much want to read to you guys. It's 82 pages long, but it deals with each motion to dismiss that Hunter's team filed, which are one for an indictment based on immunity conferred by defendant's diversion agreement. So one on diversion agreement. One motion to dismiss based on special counsel Weiss being unlawfully appointed, which is basically Ed Meese's thing, just put here for Weiss instead of Smith. Motion to dismiss the indictment for selective and vindictive prosecution. Motion to dismiss the indictment for due process violations. Motion to dismiss count one is untimely. Motion to dismiss counts 2 and 6, in part due to duplicity. Motion to dismiss count 9 based on selective prosecution. Motion to dismiss counts 14 for improper venue. Motion, like all of those, dude. Now, the judge denied it. He denied the motions to dismiss. But in his denial, he goes through each one. He goes through each one and gives his reasons for why. And that's what makes you want to read this whole thing. I just don't have time right now. But if you guys would be interested in me reading this entire thing, it's just like one episode. Like, that's what we're going to do in that one episode, is we're reading this order on Hunter's motions to dismiss. Let me know in the comments. I would appreciate it. Cause it would be a big undertaking, you know, but I think it could be worth it. In particular, because he's appealed to the Circuit Court of Appeals, the Ninth Circuit. So he was denied, and Hunter's attorneys, 3 days, 4 days later, yeah, 4 days later, notice of appeal right there, that he is appealing that order to dismiss up to the next level. So we'll see what happens, because this hasn't gone away. It could be that those judges on the Circuit Court of Appeals buy into some of these arguments. I mean, it's a shotgun of them. It's a whole dozen, but we'll see. But I am interested in reading this. In Delaware, similar news. He has appealed over here. He also filed a bunch of motions to dismiss. And they have appealed this to the Third Circuit Court of Appeals. And in theirs, it's not written the same way over here. They are appealing the order number 98, 101 memorandum and order, and 99 opinion, 97 memorandum and opinion. That's how it's written on this one. So let's look at what those are. So 97, 98, 99, 101. motion to dismiss the indictment based on the diversion agreement. Denying motion for issuance rule 17. Selective and vindictive prosecution. Okay. So over here, they've appealed the motion to dismiss for the immunity in the diversion agreement, and then for selective and vindictive prosecution. The judge denied both of those, and they are appealing those to the Third Circuit, which I may want to read those too, because this is pretty interesting, because Hunter Biden is now going through some of the same stuff that Trump has gone through. And I honestly think this case should be thrown out, this one in Delaware, over the gun charge. I really do. I think the gun law is unconstitutional. Especially after New York v. Bruin. So the Supreme Court case, that was the opinion that came down last June. So I really do, guys. And watch it happen. Watch Hunter's gun charge get thrown out, and it's correct. And it's something Second Amendment supporters should support, but or be happy about. But everybody's going to moan about it, because they're going to say that the president's son got off, and it's going to look like this huge favoritism to Hunter. And there's going to be tons of families who either have someone in their family or know someone whose kid got a gun charge, or young man got a gun charge, and it's going to be similar. And that gun charge ruined their life. And they're going to be like, how can this the president's son gets off, but my son doesn't? Like, it's going to be that kind of a thing. I don't know, but I don't know that for sure, but that's my feeling. Okay. Let's talk about Trump. I'm making good time. I must be caffeinated now that I drank this whole thing. Okay. In Florida. Since I was last on here, since yesterday, there have been a number of filings in Judge Cannon's case, in the Docs case. I'm going to need to catch myself up, because I haven't looked at any of these. So you guys are going to get to go with me. So before I do that, that's not what I wanted to do. I'm going to log in. I don't want to show you guys my login information. You guys might hack in and change all my alerts. Right? Now I got to find the case again. If I was pro, I would throw up some advertisements for my links and my affiliate links and honey and bootleg sauce and salsa and seasonings or Manly Cans or Ko-Fi.com. Just pretend I have those ads going right now. Instead of you guys just staring at my face in a hotel room. Okay. Maybe I should do that. Maybe I should make like an advertising screen or something when I need to log in. Like, just throw up a screen that has all my links on it. I don't know. Okay. Let's go back to this. Yeah, I got it. Okay. Got it right. Oh, I didn't open Pacer. Oops. All right. If you guys clicked on my link tree lately, you should. Make sure you're following me on all those socials. Check out my support links. Thank you very much. And we're back. Okay. So there's probably no reason for me to hide all that. I'm just doing it. It's a good practice, though. Good practice. You never know. All right. The last things that were going on in this case, I remember we got this restricted. I remember Judge Cannon came out with her order that, what was it? What was her order? I forgot. Oh my gosh, all these cases are running together, guys. That's right. She denied Trump's motion to dismiss based on Presidential Records Act. That was the last thing that we were looking at here, I think. And then she set some new dates. And then she had the order on sealing the motions to compel discovery, or sealing request associated with it. And then Waltine Nauta came in and filed his motions to dismiss. Which I don't, we did not read that, right? See, we did new orders from Judge Cannon. Okay. So since then, she has a transcript of the hearing on 412, motion for leave to file, motion denying leave for file, reply to response. Okay. This is. One of them. And then we have motion for leave to file amicus. Notice striking response. Corrected reply to response. Order denying certain pretrial motions filed by Nauta and De La Vera. That's an order. Paperless order denying motion for leave to file amicus. Then we have government's fourth motion for certain redactions as to Waltine Nauta. Okay, let's take a look. President Trump's reply in support of his motion for an adjournment of deadlines for defendants' Rule 16 expert disclosures and SIPA 5 notice. Special counsel's office both fails to identify any prejudice in the to the government if the court grants a brief extension of Rule 16 and SIPA 5 deadlines and does not earnestly acknowledge President Trump's constitutional right of counsel to counsel of his choice. The SCO inexplicably, they've been calling it, this must be a different author, because they have been calling Jack Smith's, they've been calling it The Office. See, this is Todd Blanche and Kais, which are the usual authors, but they're now saying SCO instead of Office. All right, the SCO inexplicably asserts that defendants are wrong with no prejudice would result. Yet the SCO makes no effort to actually identify how the government would be prejudiced by an extension of time to allow President Trump and his counsel the right to defend him in New York and before this court. The SCO then ignores the obvious and substantial prejudice to President Trump. So there's a battle going on here where Trump wants deadlines in this case extended because he's literally on trial in person 4 days out of the week in New York, and his counsel are there with him. And he has a right to be able to use the counsel of his choice. And it's not his fault that all these prosecutors decide to file their cases so close together. It's all election interference. They're trying to stop the man. Simply put, President Trump and his counsel cannot prepare or even discuss the required filings anywhere but an appropriate SCIF, a virtually impossible task given President Trump and his representatives Blanche and Bove's involvement in People v. Trump in New York, Manhattan case with Bragg. The SCO argues President Trump's constitutional rights are not implicated because his counsel has had months to prepare and will only be in trial 4 days a week. This premise is untethered to reality and disregards the substantial motion practice that has occurred before this court. And it lists a bunch of them. President Trump and his counsel have not been sitting idle over the past months and have worked diligently to advance the case forward, blah, blah, blah. In its opposition, the SCO seemingly ignores Blanche and Bove's unavailability in this district due to the People v. Trump trial and steals clear of the fact that Mr. Bove is principally responsible for all classified and SIPA litigation in this case on behalf of President Trump. This argument is disingenuous at best because just last month at a hearing before this court, the SCO lauded Mr. Bove and recognized his indispensability to President Trump's team in filing a SIPA 5 notice. Quote, one, Mr. Blanche was expressing some shock over the fact that we wouldn't think, that we wouldn't know, that we might want to litigate the Section 5. I will just tell the court that I saw their notice in the election case and it was woefully inadequate. I mean, it sought things that had not even been produced in discovery. It was noticing things that were in somewhere in the intelligence community's realm. And that's why our colleagues in the case filed their motion to strike. We have every expectation, knowing again Mr. Bove and his experience, that the court, that they would, in this case, they will file a sufficient and sufficient notice. Okay. So we don't expect there to be litigation. The SCO cannot seriously contend that SIPA 5, whereby a defendant must provide particularized notice setting forth the specifically classified information which he believes to be necessary to his defense, is not a critical stage. The SCO also cannot seriously contend Mr. Bove is indispensable in this process. Thus, even setting aside the lack of availability noted in the motion, local counsel are not capable of handling alone the task remaining to finalize SIPA 5 processes, or the SIPA 5 process. Footnote. As the special counsel's office is well aware, local counsel are not even able to discuss the relevant issues or seek any guidance from Mr. Bove outside the Florida SCIF. Any and all prejudice thus inheres to President Trump, not the government. And this is making sense. Although authority like United States versus Verderame arise from a denial of a motion to continue trial rather than pretrial deadline, the thrust of the court's holding applies equally in this instance. Okay. So they want these deadlines moved because of the trial in New York. This is the same thing. Did I open it twice? Yeah, I did. Okay. Order denying certain pretrial motions filed by defendants Nada and De La Vera. So this is De La Vera's motion to dismiss, which we read, and defendant Nada's motion for a bill of particulars and to dismiss the obstruction counts for failure to state a claim. Upon reviewing the relevant filings and fully advised of the premise, defendant's motions are denied. Oh, does she grant a bill of particulars, though? Defendant De La Vera's motion to dismiss or for a bill of particulars. The argument in defendant De La Vera's motion is do not warrant dismissal of the obstruction charges against him. As grounds for dismissal of those counts, De La Vera identifies various topics or allegations that are not contained in the superseding indictment, namely specific allegations about his knowledge of classified documents or the contents of the boxes, or generally, or about his knowledge of an official proceeding. De La Vera also argues, again in support of dismissal, that the allegations in the indictment do not show that he was capable of acting with the required corrupt criminal intent to support the alleged obstruction offenses. These characterizations are not grounds to dismiss the obstruction counts against De La Vera. He does not meaningfully dispute that the charging document satisfies the minimum pleading standards accepted by the 11th Circuit, and it does. The obstruction counts track the cited statutory language in 18 U.S.C. 1512b2b, c1, and k, and the indictment as a whole provides sufficient details to enable De La Vera to prepare a defense. To apprise him of the charged offenses and to rely upon any subsequent judgment as a bar against double jeopardy. Any particular challenges to the special counsel's evidentiary showing can be made at trial, where the special counsel will bear the entire burden of proof as to all essential elements of the obstruction offenses. So denied, but you guys can bring all this stuff to trial, try and win there. The same holds true for the false statement charge in count 42, which again satisfies the minimum pleading standards based on the inclusion of required statutory language. Okay. De La Vera's arguments about the vagueness of the questions related to the boxes, stuff, personal stuff, clothes, furniture, and items during the recorded FBI interview are more suitable for trial. As are De La Vera's challenges to the alleged materiality of his statements in light of the relevant chronology. For similar reasons, the arguments in De La Vera's motion do not warrant a bill of particulars. Darn. As to the false statement charge in count 42, and as discussed during the hearing, the indictment provides an excerpt of the alleged false statements on which the special counsel relies. And all parties agree that De Oliveira has been provided the full interview transcript in discovery. Whatever deficiencies may exist with respect to the manner of questioning during the interview is a matter for trial. With respect to count 33, the indictment itemizes the alleged manner and means of the conspiracy in list form. And more broadly, the indictment as a whole adequately apprises De Oliveira of the aspects of the alleged conspiracy as to which the special counsel alleges he was directly involved. While the indictment does not contain additional details about De Oliveira's specific knowledge of the grand jury proceeding or the grand jury subpoena, it again tracks the statutory mens rea language of 1512. It alleges that he and his co-defendants attempted to delete security camera footage to conceal the footage from the FBI and grand jury, and it lists specific purposes of the alleged conspiracy. The counsel is not required to plead or provide more specificity in a form of bill of particulars. So a bill of particulars could largely say the same thing. So no reason to get one. Now, on Nada's motion, which we did not read, he's only recently filed it, and we have not read it on the show. Where'd it go? It's Waltine Nada filed one to dismiss. This is on April 11th. And another one on April 11th. I want to take a look at these real quick. 117 pages if you include the attachments. Okay. So on his, this is for a bill of particulars, motion for a bill of particulars. Defendant Waltine Nada is charged in 8 counts of the July 27th, 2023 superseding indictment. Violation of 18 U.S.C. withholding a document and record violation, blah, 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 blah. Those are all the charges. At bottom, the charges stem from an alleged conspiracy to conceal boxes at Mar-a-Lago in January 2021, blah, blah, blah. Mr. Nada, who served as a valet to President Trump during his administration, explained that while he packed some boxes during his employment at the White House, the boxes he personally packed only contained personal and household items, including but not limited to shoes, hats, shampoo, and undergarments. Oh, just a moment. So sorry about that. There's some sort of confusion with my room, and the front desk keeps giving it out. They put me in it, and They keep trying to put other people in here with me, and there's only one bed, and I'm not really interested in sharing it with anybody. It's kind of a funny situation. I'm guessing that my key no longer works since they've given out. They tried to put 200 people in this room and they gave them keys. I'm going to have to go down there and deal with it after this, after I finish recording this. All right. All right. So what I was wanting to do here is I just want to get a general idea of what Nada is arguing in his motion for a bill of particulars. He did not personally pack any boxes with documents. Nada did not, nor did he observe boxes of documents being packed during the packing process in January 2021. Mr. Nada further explained that he did not return to Mar-a-Lago until October of 2021. Some of the boxes during the packing process at the White House were labeled, and some of them were just taken away by the movers. Once the boxes arrived at Mar-a-Lago, they were stored in various locations, including the White and Gold Ballroom, Business Center, Bathroom, Shower, and Storage Room, superseding indictment, and da 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 da. As described by Nada, the boxes located outside of Pine Hall were white, brown, Xerox, and Baker's boxes. These similar boxes were utilized at the White House by President Trump, but Mr. Nada only saw newspapers, ties, and personal effects in the banker's boxes at the White House. Mr. Nada believed those boxes were going to Mar-a-Lago, although he advised he did not help move boxes that were sent to Mar-a-Lago. Mr. Nada confirmed upon his arrival at Mar-a-Lago in October 2021, he observed some of the boxes that were previously packed at the White House in a storage room. However, he did not know who physically placed them there. Mr. Nada required permission to enter the storage room, which required a key. Mr. Nada first began working for President Trump as a valet in January 2017. Da, da, da. At various times, Mr. Nada has acknowledged moving boxes. For example, on January 17, 2022, Mr. Nada told the FBI he and another employee moved approximately 15 to 17 boxes placed outside of Pine Hall so that they could be loaded onto a vehicle stationed outside of the Mar-a-Lago Club and placed on a truck en route to the National Archives and Records Administration. Mr. Nada never opened the boxes collected from Pine Hall and was unaware of what documents, if any, each box contained. Mr. Nada further explained that he never saw documents with classification markings at the Mar-a-Lago residence. In pertinent part, the superseding indictment alleges that following the receipt of a grand jury subpoena for documents with classified markings, Trump Attorney 1 made arrangements to search boxes stored in a storage room at Mar-a-Lago on June 2, 2022. Superseding indictment at 22. Okay. Thereafter, the indictment alleges Mr. Nada, at President Trump's direction, moved approximately 64 boxes from the storage room and brought them to President Trump's residence. Then on June 2nd, 2022, prior to Trump Attorney 1's arrival, the indictment alleges that Nada and De Oliveira moved approximately 30 boxes back from President Trump's residence to the storage room. Thus, the indictment insinuates when Trump Attorney 1, Evan Corcoran, performed the June 2nd search of the boxes for documents with classification markings, there were approximately 34 boxes missing from the storage room. Several months later, on August 8, 2022, the indictment alleges the FBI executed a court-authorized search warrant of the Mar-a-Lago Club in which it seized 75 documents purportedly with classification markings from the storage room. Okay, and he's asking for a bill of particulars in this. Yeah, he's asking the court to order the special counsel's office to prepare a bill of particulars setting forth the particularity with particularity, the pertinent facts omitted from the superseding indictment. He's charged with knowingly and willfully making a materially false, fictitious, and fraudulent statement or representation in his May 26, 2022 voluntary interview with the FBI. The indictment alleges he advised the FBI during his interview that the first time he ever saw the boxes that he moved to a truck for NARA was just prior to moving them. The indictment alleges these statements were false because the boxes in Pine Hall had been moved from the storage room to Pine Hall, and Mr. Nada had observed the boxes in the storage room and moved them to various locations at Mar-a-Lago Club. However, the indictment fails to allege that the specific boxes provided to NARA had come from the storage room, as opposed to another area of Mar-a-Lago, or what was contained in the boxes actually had classified markings. Given that many boxes contained no documents with classified markings, but instead contained only personal items. Okay, and then his motion to dismiss. Dismiss for failure to state an offense or because as applied to Mr. Nauta, the offenses charged are unconstitutionally vague in violation of the due process clause of the Constitution, or in the alternative pursuant to the rule of lenity. Defendant Waltine Nauta is charged in 8 counts of the July 27, 2023 indictment. With these charges, at bottom, the charges stem from an alleged conspiracy to conceal the boxes. Once the boxes arrived at Mar-a-Lago, they were stored in various locations, including the white and gold ballroom. Read all that. This is largely a copypasta. Thereafter, the indictment alleges Mr. Nauta, at President Trump's direction, moved approximately 64 boxes from the storage room and brought them to President Trump's residence. Then on June 2nd, 2022, prior to Trump Attorney 1's arrival, the indictment alleges that Nauta and De La Vera moved approximately 30 boxes back from President Trump's residence to the storage room. Thus, the indictment insinuates when Trump Attorney 1 performed the June 2nd call. Now I have a phone call here. This is an interesting stay. Sorry for the other interruption. The front desk called me and apparently I'm a ghost. Apparently they put all my information in the system and it spit out a receipt and it charged my card and all of that. And then it disappeared me from the system and I'm just a ghost. So, but they're apologizing and at least they know someone's here. So maybe I won't get any more surprise visitors. The last surprise visitor was Pastor Al, actually, which was nice. It's good to see him. He's a nice guy. All right. Thus, the indictment insinuates when President Trump, the FBI executed an authorized search warrant. Okay. Given that no matter how this court determines to apply the term corruptly in the 1512 counts, some level of ambiguity still will exist. This court should use the rule of lenity to resolve the ambiguity in Nauta's favor. For the foregoing reasons, Nauta respectfully requests this court to dismiss the counts. Okay. Let's see what she had to say about it, Judge Cannon. She says, Nauta's request for a bill of particulars is denied. Nauta seeks clarity about which boxes were allegedly concealed, moved, and or searched on August 8th, whether the search boxes were among the 34 that he allegedly concealed on June 2nd, 2022, whether any of the allegedly moved boxes contained documents marked classified, and which of the seized boxes were the boxes allegedly moved by NADA containing classified material. Although there is reason to understand the request for additional specificity as to the boxes and their contents, even in light of the lengthy indictment, the special counsel is not legally obligated to provide more detail. The court cannot say that the indictment as a whole lacks sufficient information to assist NADA in preparing for trial, and the discovery provided in this case is exceedingly voluminous. Well, that's true. Defendant NADA also moves to dismiss the charged obstruction counts as unconstitutionally vague. The court addresses these arguments in turn. NADA's principal submission is that the term corruptly, as used in charge 1512 counts, is subject to multiple still developing and contested judicial constructions of the term such that it fails to give ordinary people fair notice of the conduct it punishes and invites arbitrary enforcement. This multiple meanings vagueness contention is worthy of serious consideration, but it does not lead this court to conclude that dismissal of the obstruction counts is warranted. In United States v. Frisk, addressing a sufficiency of the evidence challenge, the 11th Circuit described corruptly as with an improper purpose and to engage in conduct knowingly and dishonestly with the specific intent to subvert, impede, or obstruct an official proceeding. There is no pattern jury instruction. There is no pattern jury instruction for the term. Okay. However, the 11th Circuit has not had an occasion to grapple with its meaning. I wonder if this is going to be the occasion. Beyond the 11th Circuit, case law as it has developed reveals a menu of formulations for the term corruptly in the obstruction context. In Arthur Anderson LLP versus United States, the Supreme Court addressed the phrase knowingly corruptly persuades in 18 U.S.C. 1512b, indicating that corruptly is, quote, normally associated with wrongful, immoral, depraved, or evil. The court also referenced the phrase conscious of wrongdoing in its decision. Years later, in United States versus Aguilar, 1995, Justice Scalia referred in concurrence to the longstanding and well-accepted meaning of the term corruptly, endorsing a definition that requires proof of an act done voluntarily and intentionally to bring about either an unlawful result or a lawful result by some unlawful method, with a hope or expectation of either financial gain or other benefit of oneself or a benefit of another person. And further within the D.C. Circuit, different judges have presented studied views on the term. Okay. The above summary, not exhaustive in scope, lends support to NADA's observation that the term corruptly in 1512 is subject to different, somewhat amorphous formulations about wrongfulness and unlawfulness, the net effect of which is to engender legitimate questions, some might even say confusion, about the definition of the term in the realm of obstruction and related crimes. Moreover, this discussion, at least in a broader sense, continues before the Supreme Court this term, as evidenced by Snyder v. United States and Fisher v. United States. There is also the added layer, in this case, that count 33 charges a conspiracy with multiple provisions of Section 1512 baked into it, followed by a specific purpose allegation whose evidentiary impact and instructional significance is not entirely clear. Notwithstanding these reasonable questions about the definition of the term corruptly, NADA's as-applied vagueness challenge fails under existing law. First, the 11th Circuit rejected a vagueness challenge to the term corruptly in 1512b, having little trouble concluding that the term corrupt provides adequate notice so long as it is defined as being motivated by an improper purpose. That is United States v. Schatz, 1998. Second, as noted, the 11th Circuit has described the term in a manner consistent with the Supreme Court's earlier version in Arthur Anderson. And third, NADA has not identified any case in which a court took the step of dismissing a charge in an indictment on vagueness grounds because of an arguably unclear mens rea element. The more charted course, if necessary, consistent with the principles of restraint in assessing criminal laws, is to adopt a more stringent mens rea construction and to assess the state of the allegations under the more rigorous test. Having done so here, and without expressing a final opinion on the specific mens rea definition to submit to the jury as to the obstruction counts, the court is in general agreement with the special counsel that the allegations in the indictment, including the specific purpose and manner and means of allegations in count 33, in addition to the other intent-related allegations in the remaining obstruction counts, provide enough of a basis to deny Nada's request for dismissal on vagueness grounds, even assuming a more stringent mens rea definition were called for. Turning finally to to Nada's more particularized challenge for failure to state a claim under Rule 12b-3bv, the court rejects this argument for similar reasons as previously stated. Nada argues that none of the obstruction counts specifically allege that he took actions to procure a benefit for himself or anyone else. Even under that definition, however, that's assuming a stricter mens rea formulation is warranted. The indictment as a whole, accepted as true for purposes of this order, contains sufficient allegations of a corrupt intent. Conclusion, it's denied. I think that was kind of thoughtful from Ken. As it should be. I like that. I like that. I like what she had to say there. And I like how she went about it. Okay, and then finally, in this case, we have government's fourth motion for certain redactions. And this is Jack Smith wanting certain redactions. Remember, this battle's been playing out for a while now, where Trump's getting discovery, and he should get discovery, but the DOJ has the right to redact certain things, or to ask for certain things to be redacted, and there's various reasons for that. So this is just the next part of that battle. Government filed this motion to respectfully request certain redactions, and this one has to do with Nada, not Trump. The government is filing this motion publicly, but it's emailing to Chambers and Defense Counsel red box versions of the SIR replies, which now that they're using, I guess at some point they decided they would start calling it red boxing as for what they want to redact. They only started doing this within the past like couple months, but that must be what it means. And that's it. He's just, this has to do with Nada and let's see. Okay. Yeah, they just want to redact. Mostly it's names and personal identifying information so that way these jurors can't, or some of these witnesses can't be found out and then intimidated, which are sound reasons. Now, in the first edition of this, episode 265, that I threw away in the recycle bin, I went through Technofog's article, and that was actually one of the things I didn't like that I did. So Technofog puts his material behind a paywall, and I don't like showing people's content that they put behind paywalls. Even though I don't like paywalls and I don't think people should do paywalls, I think all information should be free, I still understand the paywall thing. And I think it's completely legitimate. I don't think it's immoral or unethical or anything. It's just, I just don't like it. But with Technofog, he put some of his stuff behind a paywall, or almost all of it. And I'm a subscriber to his, and I really like his work. So I paid to read his material. But I don't want to pay to read his material and then put his material on my show. That just doesn't feel right to me. So that was one of the things that led me to trash that episode. Even absent that, I still would have done it. But that was one of the things that bothered me about it. So Technofog did a summary of the jurors. And if you want to look it up, the jurors that have been chosen so far as of Tuesday night, which were... So far they had selected seven, I think. I think he has it at six, but there were actually seven, right? He's got it at six. So I made a post after reading Technofog's write-up, after reading some of the threads that were out there about Trump's Manhattan trial and the jury selection. And I decided it went pretty well for him. And Technofog thinks it went pretty well as well also. And Trump put out this post saying, I thought strikes were supposed to be unlimited when we were picking our jury. I was then told we only had 10, not nearly enough when we were purposely given the second worst venue in the country. Don't worry, we have the first worst also. As the witch hunt continues, election interference. Okay, this is Trump comms all day long. This is amazing. So, one, Trump lies. I thought strikes were supposed to be unlimited when we were picking our jury. I was then told there were only 10. That is a lie. Do you guys really believe that Trump doesn't know how many strikes his lawyers have in his Manhattan criminal trial? Do you really think he was ignorant of that? No, he was not. Do you really think he believed that he had unlimited strikes? Would it make any sense at all for him to have unlimited strikes? No. Trump is well aware, and he was there in the courtroom as they talked about how this would go forth. Everybody knows that Trump was fully aware. This first part of what Trump is saying is a lie. And he is doing it on purpose because he knows that the media will come over here and they will cover this post just because he said something wrong, incorrect. They will highlight this post, and they did. And they made fun of him for not knowing how many strikes he had and blah, blah, blah. And why is President Trump so dumb? Like, they ran all their usual stories, okay? That this is like the flashy bait right here, this or the stinky bait, whatever, that gets all the swampy fish to come over. Like, this, that's what this is, right? Okay. But the next part, not nearly enough when we were purposefully given the second worst venue in the country, meaning Manhattan. From his perspective, second worst venue in the country. Purposefully given. This was selected. This is, to me, this says by design. Now, I happen to think there's a white hat design behind all of it, but I think we all agree there's a design by it, behind it, even if you don't think it's white hat or a patriot. You think it's all bad guys, okay? Fine. But we all agree that it's purposeful, right? He's stating that it's purposeful, that it's happening in Manhattan right now. This last line. Don't worry. We have the first worst also as the witch hunt continues. First worst is DC. Witch hunt refers to Hillary Clinton. So, I gotta tell you guys, this is an absolute truism about Trump. He likes to complain about things that are going well for him. And if you look at the way jury selection has gone, it's gone well for him. Manhattan is like a 90% Democrat stronghold. The chances of him getting a conservative in that jury are like 1 in 10. It's not probable. And the fact that the jurors that he's ended up with so far don't seem to be wacko leftist is really good. He doesn't need to get all of them to be conservative. He just needs one or two that will be strong enough to not give in to the TDS riddled people that they're in the jury box with. Like, I still think he's going to be convicted no matter what he does, but things are going well for Trump. And so he's complaining about them. He does it all the time. It's kayfabe. He does it all the time. So, Optimal Red Pillar here, good follow on X, by the way. Shout out to him. He asked me to elaborate a bit on this. And so I said, there's no chance Trump would ever, ever, ever get a jury that was fair or well-balanced. Not in Manhattan. There's no chance. But from what we know about the jurors, he did make out all right. Maybe even the best he could have given the circumstances. Now, since I wrote this, there's been a bit of a kerfuffle with two jurors being dismissed. One of them because they didn't think they could handle it, basically. And another one because they lied on some questions or something. But there's been, since then, while I've been traveling today, there's been some more stuff going on with the jurors, and there's more jurors being selected. So this ain't over. But so far, but even that aside, what I say here still remains true, okay? Because so far, he's made out about as best as you could expect, given the circumstances. So, you know, if you're on his counsel's team, you're not thinking, ooh, we're going to get a jury that is going to get an acquittal. You're thinking, we just need to get one or two conservative people who won't fall for this BS and will be firm and will not give in to peer pressure. who don't, they need to not hate Trump and they need to not be given to peer pressure, right? That's who they're looking for. One or two of those and they're good. They'll get a hung jury and it'll be fine. But that's the best they can achieve. That's the ceiling. Okay. Perhaps more importantly though, Trump has taken up a huge amount of InfoWar bandwidth over the past 3 days. And also last week, thanks to this case trial and the lead up to it. That's excellent because, as we keep on saying, me, BB, John, others, these cases and trials are his campaign. In fact, I had an Uber driver today that I said that to. And he kind of let me talk for a minute. And I think he enjoyed listening to me. I think he did. But I said that to a guy and he kind of went and looked at me, rearview mirror. And once people click with that, and I connected it for him to how Trump always ends up turning things around and winning in the end. He's so good at spinning all these situations to where he comes out on top of the end. He's proven right at the end. He wins in the end. He's so good at it. And this, with what's going on with these cases and trials, is they are his campaign. So what is the win? What is your objective every day if the cases and trials are your campaign? Your objective is to consume as much media bandwidth as you possibly can and then direct their attention to the things you want them to be directed to. So with that attention, he has what? He has control of the narratives. He has the attention of the media. He has the attention of the people. And he can direct their attention where he wants it to go. He can have them look at the bodega, which ended up being hilarious, right? He can have them look at election interference via Lawfare, because that's what's happening. He can point to the gag order and how he can't say anything. He can point to the economy and how badly the economy is doing and how great it did under him. And yet here he is sitting in a courtroom because the Democrats, the people who ruined the economy that we have right now, don't want him back in office. He can point to New Yorkers standing outside the courtroom, the courthouse, seeing the Star Spangled Banner. He can do all of these things effortlessly. And because he's trapped in Manhattan, having to be there in person, he's not going to be unhappy about that, guys, because he gets to run the headline. This mean judge won't let me go to Barron's graduation, which actually the judge hasn't ruled on that yet. But notice how that was weaponized. InfoWar weaponized by patriots and by Trump supporters. As soon as they heard that the judge hadn't made a decision yet, or would think about, or may need Trump there in person on Barron's graduation and on some other special day. Everybody reacting to it. This crooked judge, he's so mean. This is such a crock of BS, like all that stuff. That's all weaponization. It's really fake news because the judge hasn't made a decision, but, it's still being used to help Trump. And since he's locked in being in that courtroom Monday, Tuesday, and Thursday, Friday of every week until the trial's over, every single one of those days that he's there, he has the moment when he goes in to make statements to the press and to talk to people. He has lunch, and he has when he leaves to do press conferences, to talk to people that are gathered in the area. He's basically can campaign in New York City. He's basically been mandated by a judge. He's been ordered by a judge to campaign in Manhattan every day until this trial's over. That's essentially what he's been ordered to do. And I don't think that, as somebody that's on Devolution Power Hour, now, I don't really think Trump can win New York. But if Trump being in New York over and over again like this, if it manages to remind New Yorkers of the New York Trump built and how great that city was, especially as compared to how it is now, he might make New York competitive and force the Democrats to have to expend resources in New York State where they thought they had everything safe, which would take away resources from other areas. So there's a play here, I think, where if Trump does this right, he makes himself more competitive in New York. That's all it would take. He would just have to be more to get them to expend resources. And then any Republicans running under him, it's going to give them a boost. Any New York Republicans who are also on the ticket, it's going to give them a bit of a boost on that ticket when Election Day comes around, right? So be interesting to see if any of those people start showing up and trying to get some of that limelight and some of that bandwidth as Trump is coming and going. Like maybe he goes and has dinner with some Republican candidate who's running for a state House office or state Senate office or whatever, you know. This could benefit other candidates as well. So, but the whole thing is going to be entertaining. And Trump's going to expertly maneuver his way through all of it, just like he always does. And he's gonna turn it all into his benefit and to his campaign's benefit, which is what he's been doing all week. And that's why I say that jury selection went well for him. Totally understand people being upset about it, but there is an angle here that's a white pill, that's a rational, very reasonable white pill to swallow on all of this. And once you see that these campaigns are, or these cases and trials are his campaign, you just appreciate them so much more and enjoy them more. Now, I want to go back to what he said here in this True Social post. Don't worry, we have the first worst also as the witch hunt continues. What trial is going to happen in DC that Trump is talking about here? Well, Smith told Supreme Court justices that he would still press on with his obstruction case against Trump, even if they decide in favor of Fisher, and even if they grant Trump presidential immunity, which most people think they will. Most people are starting to think, you know what, SCOTUS is going to uphold presidential immunity, and it's probably going to apply to Trump. And Jack Smith's case in D.C., it's going to get gutted because they're going to be official. It's going to come down to official acts and whether or not they were official acts. And if they were, he has presidential immunity. But Jack Smith says he's going to go ahead and pursue obstruction charges anyway, regardless. So I think Trump is expecting to go to trial in D.C. later this year. Maybe not on everything he brought. Maybe not a case that involves all the charges he brought, but some. So what I'm kind of thinking is we're gonna watch happen right now. Like the way the battlefield's looking to me, as far as Trump's lawfare, is that this Manhattan thing's gonna happen. I think he gets convicted. I think he gets sentenced this summer. And I bet it's no jail time. I bet it's a fine and like probation or something. But I bet it's no jail time. That'll be the sentence. That's what I'm thinking. And then right after or right before, SCOTUS is going to make their decision on presidential immunity and Fisher. They're going to decide in favor of Fisher, and hundreds of January 6th defendants are going to have the opportunity to have their obstruction charge thrown out if they play their cards right and their attorneys do a good job. Hundreds of J6 defendants can have their obstruction charge thrown out. Trump can have his obstruction charge thrown out, but Jack Smith's not going to want to do it, and there's going to be a new battle between Jack Smith and Trump just on that obstruction charge. I also think that SCOTUS is going to rule in favor of Trump on presidential immunity, and I think that a lot of the charges that are brought against Trump are going to be thrown out because he has presidential immunity, but not all of them. And then I think that whatever is left, Jack Smith is going to take to trial. I don't think Trump is expecting to go to trial in Florida. I think he is thinking I think Jack Smith's preference is the DC case. And I think that the Florida case, the Docs case, is not going to be successful for Jack Smith because he wasn't able to get Nada and De Oliveira to flip on Trump which was his hope, is that he could get them to flip and lie about what Trump asked them to do. And so I don't think he's expecting that case to go to trial. I think that case is going to fall apart before then. I think presidential immunity is going to apply to Trump's actions. I know that Cannon denied Trump's order to motion to dismiss based on the PRA. But I think the PRA is going to come back up again. But it could be that, like, I've just been thinking about how to accelerate the two-tier justice system, Trump the rebel, Trump the guy outside the system, the system's trying to kill Trump, trying to stop him being president. How do you highlight that like never before? You have Jack Smith, who's been shut down by SCOTUS, continue to bring a completely broken case against Trump anyway, in crooked DC, in front of crooked Judge Chutkan. And meanwhile, Trump keeps complaining that he can't campaign because they're trying to keep him off the campaign trail by keeping him in the courtroom. Yet that is him campaigning. And I think that's what Trump is telling us here. That's my thought. So I want to highlight for you, he does say, don't worry. And you shouldn't. You should not worry. He's got this. So, all right, fam. That is my show for today. Thank you very much for being here. Thank you very much for hitting the thumbs up. I hope you do. Leave a comment if you like the show. If you don't like the show, also leave a comment. Whatever. Share the show. And if you're interested in supporting the show, justhuman.sosec.com. Ko-Fi.com, Vincent Honey Farms, Bootleg, Manly Cans, merch, all those are there. All those links are in my link tree and in the description of the show. So I can't do this show without your support. And those of you who generously give it to me, I am so grateful to you. I love what I do. And looking forward to recording another episode at some point. Maybe over this weekend. I'm going to hang out with a lot of people here at GART, of course, which is what I got to go do right now. But if I have the advantage of a moment of a couple hours to do something, then I'm going to do it. So y'all stay safe. Have a wonderful weekend. And remember, we can't win every battle, and we won't, but we will win the war. God bless.